Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, I'm talking with Anastasia Curwood about her insightful new biography, Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. Curwood is a beloved and brilliant professor from the University of Kentucky. She's also interim chair of the history department there. In addition to that, she's very busy as director of the Commonwealth Institute for Black Studies at UK. Curwood's scholarship focuses on the interface between private life and historical context for Black Americans in the 20th century. Her first book, called Stormy Weather, focused on marriages between middle-class African Americans between the two world wars. I'm really excited to talk to her today about Shirley Chisholm, around 50 years after she ran for president of the United States. If you like what you hear, please follow Booked Up wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends. Okay, let's dive in. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Nice to meet you virtually.
Nice to meet you, likewise.
So I have to tell you how much I enjoyed reading this book, especially right now. Although I can't decide whether I'm elated to know so much more about Shirley Chisholm or if I was weeping because so much of her project we still need to accomplish. And so much of it right now has been rolled back. And it just, I don't know how it felt to you writing this book right now.
Yeah. That's talk about starting with a doozy. I had a lot of feels writing this book. I remember where I was sitting in traffic and I thought to myself, what would have happened if the Comprehensive Child Development Act was passed in 1971?
Right.
Universal childcare. I remember I was sitting in traffic in my car. I know where what traffic light I was at. And it just hit me. What if universal childcare was available right now? And I mean, the world that we live in would have been transformed. And that was something, I suppose that was something that was near and dear to her that she did not accomplish, but it was so, so close. It was just, it was a matter of Richard Nixon's signature and his advisors telling him that this was a radical piece of social legislation.
They passed both the houses. It just wasn't enough for the supermajority to override his veto. How close
exactly.
Do you think? I read that and I agree with you. I'm trying to think, I would have been a small child then, but when I was growing up and I was in high school in the 80s, I thought, okay, well, when I'm an adult, we'll have figured out the child care thing.
Yeah.
Like the idea that this still isn't being managed. And now even the whole public school system is, everything is so fragile because people are leaving the profession for a number of reasons, but in part because student loans make it impossible to hold those jobs and so on and so on and so on.
Exactly.
I could start singing some Cat Stevens, like Where Do the Children Play? But
right.
I think, I'm thinking since we're talking about, before we talk about our policy issues, one thing I always do whenever I read a book is I look at the acknowledgments. It tells me, sometimes you read it to see, is your name there? If it's a book about a topic that you helped a person on. But mostly I read to see who are they thinking? Who are their influences? And of course, when I looked at the acknowledgments with you, I see that you have a photo of your parents with Shirley Chisholm. So I'm just curious, was she part of your life? I think you mentioned having met her, but tell me how that impacted your decision to research her for work.
Well, it was I knew about her as a girl. And it was one of those things that I just knew about because my parents had told me. And I tell this story, it's a little bit, it's funny, but when I saw the image of her, and asked my parents who she was. They told me that's Shirley Chisholm. She ran for president, and you could too. Yes, she's a Black woman. And I tell the story that I thought about running for president because I thought, okay, that's a possibility. You know, I was weighing different occupations in my future. What do I want to be when I grow up? And you know, I think I was in probably first or second grade or something like that there.
Pretty young, and you were already considering a run.
Exactly. Yes.
Because you saw this person with your, was it the photo? Did they show you the photo that you've included in the book?
Yeah. That photo was taken by a family friend, and as was the cover photo. Michael Dobo, is a photographer. He photographed legions of important people, especially he photographed a lot of rock stars in the 70s as well. So a lot of famous people. And he was a family friend. Michael was a close friend of my parents. And so we had that photo and it's framed. I have it here in my house. And so it was just one of Dobo's photos that we looked at. I have other photos that he took of, you know, me as a child and as a baby. And so that's just something that it was just his stuff was around.
I'm looking at the photo and it says Michael Dobo, D-O-B-O. It looks like he has a website. Would people be able to see the photo on the website?
I don't know, actually, because I contacted him when I was doing this book. Because, you know, it's the original photo. And asked if he had more photos. And he did. He had the cover photo. He had that photo. He had some photographs of Chisholm speaking at a church in Boston. And the image of Chisholm hugging one of her supporters at a church in Boston, he took that. And so, so he took a bunch and I just asked him, okay, well, where, you know, can I have access to those? And so he sent me a whole contact sheet. And then when it was time to publish the book, I was like, these are just amazing. And so he generously allowed me to use them.
And it's so great because you don't usually see an academic press book with so many photos in them. And it's so nice that he let you use them. I'm gonna go back to that photo of your parents in a second. But what I also noticed, what paired so well with the story you just told about the inspiration as a child, that just the image of Shirley Chisholm was for you. I love your dedication for your book, for Carol and for Black girls who want to be president. So you're writing it also to yourself as a child. Is this your first? This isn't even your first book, but was your first book also dedicated to Carol and for Black girls who want to be president, or was that one different?
That one was different. that one was dedicated to my parents.
Okay.
That one's just dedicated to Mom and Dad.
Who is Carol?
Carol is my spouse.
Lovely.
Carol is the one who is clanking a couple of dishes in the background.
I love that. I mean, does she write books too? We could just do a twofer. She could talk about that.
Carol is an amazing writer, actually. She was an English major in college, but then she now works in a library, in the university library, one of the university libraries at Kentucky. But actually, she was an Olympic rower in between being an English major and now being a librarian.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So she's my spouse and, you know, she's been there for every step of this book. It's to myself, but it's to the future.
To other young readers. So I'm looking at the photo. This photo is so joyful. And I hope that when people buy the book, they will agree with me in the acknowledgments. It's a photo of four people in a hotel room. Mm-hmm. And it says from left, so it's Steve Curwood, Wendy Kerwood, Jean Rubenstein, and Shirley Chisholm. Were they your and the Steve Kerwood character is sort of laughing. He looks almost as tall as the ceiling, but I'm not. That might just be the angle.
It's his afro. It's because
yeah,
his afro is so tall.
Absolutely fabulous. So he's a black man with this gorgeous afro, but it's sort of more narrow than it is wide a little bit. He's wearing what looks like a tweed or I don't know, kind of jacket. Your mom is cross-legged on a bed, a white coat. It looks like those might be bell bottoms. She looks like she's a white woman with sandy brown hair. And then there's Jean Rubenstein, very diverse photo. Anyway, and then on the other, sitting on the other bed is Shirley Chisholm, dressed to the nines as she always was, a gorgeous white suit. It looks like she has a speech or some notes laid out before her. Were your parents married by the time this photo was taken, or what's the story behind this moment?
Yeah, they were 3 years married at that point. They're an interracial couple, as people can deduce from your description. And they had gotten married in Boston. They met at summer camp and through a New England yearly meeting, the Quaker meeting, regional conference. So they both were raised, both of their parents were Quakers, and they were raised Quaker.
I don't usually ask people about their parents' weddings, but a friend of mine had a Quaker wedding, and it was the most lovely experience I've had. Did your parents have one of those Quaker weddings where everyone stands up and says something about the couple?
I think so. I wasn't there.
Obviously, you might not have been there. Okay.
And they're divorced now, so they don't really talk about it.
Okay, yeah. I ask all the really good questions.
That's my guess. A really funny story, though, about their wedding that I have heard, as well as I have a wedding photo of them that's fantastic also, is that their many relatives were annoyed that there was no alcohol served at the wedding because it was held in a Quaker meeting house, the Cambridge Friends meeting house in Massachusetts. And alcohol wasn't allowed. And so there were a lot of really annoyed family members at that wedding. I have heard that story.
Wait, the wedding, you mean for the wedding celebration?
For the reception.
The reception. Huh.
No booze.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they could have, you know, had a flask outside the building if it was
that
important
to them. Well, they probably did.
Yeah. Oh, people. That's a pretty good story. So back to, since I've now made it through the acknowledgments, let's go back back to the book. She was always part of your life. But when you, what I was interested in, you sort of partially talk about this, is that this might, your book, Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics, might be the first biography. Am I getting that right?
Well, it is the first cradle-to-grave biography.
Okay.
There are some books written for young people.
Uh-huh.
And there is a book targeted at undergraduates in a college classroom written by the founder of the Shirley Chisholm Project at Brooklyn College.
Okay.
Barbara Winslow. Mm-hmm. There are a handful, but no, there is no original research, cradle to grave biography of Shirley Chisholm. Well, there was none until now.
Until now. I so much appreciate this project because the book is so good, but also for that, you know, that it will be this fixture in the historical record. Now, of course, she wrote on herself, Unbought and Unbossed, in a later book. And you talk a bit about that. So I'm just trying to understand maybe, you know, your original research. You say you didn't want to write, I never know how to pronounce this word. Is it hagiography or hagiography?
I say hagiography, I guess.
Which just means
I say it.
That's just like a very praiseworthy, like, you know, treat someone like they're a saint kind of book, right? You didn't do that.
Yeah.
So you're making, of course, I mean, you're a historian, but did you go into original archives, do interviews with people? I'm curious about the primary documents in addition to her own self-told story.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, at the beginning I was writing a hagiography. I was very impressed because, you know, yes, she was a childhood idol, but then I started to realize the substance behind the symbol. That's not a coincidental phrase, by the way. I can explain later if you want me to.
I do. I like that. I was going to steal it, but now I can't. Yeah.
I'll tell you about it. I just was really enamored of her as a figure at the beginning of the process. And I actually had somebody say to me, you know, you got to be careful of that. And I said, oh, I know. But I realized, though, actually, this is a contribution that I can make to show how human this person was. But it was a challenge. I started in the archives. I started actually at Rutgers University, which had a donation from Chisholm herself, but okay. It's a small donation of papers. Most Congress people generate reams and reams and reams of paper. And so the folks at Rutgers were saying, where is it? Where's the rest of it? Mm-hmm. And that set me on a quest to find more papers of hers. But in the meantime, the Shirley Chisholm Project at Brooklyn College collected a lot of material, oral histories that were done as interviews for the film Chisholm 72, Unbought and Unbossed, which was made by Shala Lynch in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so all the interviews that Lynch did are there. I conducted my own interviews, especially with folks who worked with and for Shirley Chisholm, many of whom have their own really interesting stories. And then eventually, fast forward a dozen years or so, I was able to get to the remaining papers that Chisholm had not donated to Rutgers University.
Where were those located?
Well, in the house that she used to live in, her last house, which is in Florida near Daytona Beach. And, it was the generosity of her family that allowed me to go and look at those. So I'm very grateful to them.
Did you stay at that location, or did you stay at a hotel and go visit? I mean, I kind of wonder how many days it was that you spent there.
I spent a total of working days. I went for five for a week once. I went for 5 days, and then I went for another 3 or so days on another occasion.
Did you use the scanning function on your phone so you could scan stuff in, or what did you do?
Yeah. So I used a little scanning app. The phones didn't have their, I guess they come with them now. Yeah.
Now it comes on your notes. I just found this out from one of my research assistants last summer. It's fabulous, but yeah.
Yeah. So I used that, or took some pictures and was able to get, and some of the photographs from that collection are in the book that the family did give permission to publish those. It was really wonderful to see those. I still never found her personal correspondence. That is not anywhere that I can. So
I wonder if she didn't want that, given her personal relationships. I mean, the time between each marriage seemed rather close. You say, it's funny, you say the word papers, but the word paper to me, that's a word that means things written on paper. So what kinds of things are you looking? Because I've looked at some archives in my own research, so I'm sure looking at receipts or dry cleaning bills or what have you. Sometimes papers might mean specifically to you, things that she reviewed in the course of her congressional work, or things written to her campaign advice. What do you mean when you say you looked at her papers?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, so you and I are old enough to remember the before email era, when
yes,
but we collected, I still have, because I'm a historian, I never throw anything out. We just collected all sorts of paper.
So, letters from friends, all these things, right?
Yes. So it's anything. It's any piece of paper, not usually artifacts, although there's sort of an artifact in there that was pretty cool. But it still counts as papers because it's letters, it's bills, it's photographs, newspaper clippings. She had several albums of newspaper clippings from the presidential campaign in 1972 that was really helpful to me because it was easy enough for me to find the New York Times articles and the Washington Post articles, and even some of the New York Amsterdam News articles, the black paper in the city. But she had clippings from, you know, a small regional newspaper in North Carolina that I just never would have found. So it was really helpful to have all that. She has minutes of meetings, especially meetings mm-hmm. of the National Political Congress of Black Women, which she was a co-founder of, and its first chairwoman after her congressional career. So there are meeting minutes in there, and you can see, you know, what Donna Brazile said during a meeting.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So
that's another remarkable thing I should say in the book, seeing some of these names of people that I didn't realize she would have been connected to, like the Pauli Murray connection, which we can get to, is just mind blowing.
Cool? Yeah.
So you can't get away with saying there was a cool artifact and then not tell me what the cool artifact was.
Okay. So I don't know if you've read The Good Fight, but for folks who read The Good Fight, there's a, she says this line in there about how
this is her second book.
Her second memoir. Okay. It's the memoir of the campaign, the 72 campaign. And she published it in 73. And she says, she talks about the dangers that she was in on the campaign trail. And she really felt a keen sense of danger while she was there. And in the middle of it,
especially staying at the Lorraine Hotel, I couldn't believe that.
She couldn't sleep.
That was
sleep
the only
there.
Place that they would let her stay. Was it a Green Book situation of racial discrimination? I mean, why would you put a candidate in the hotel where MLK was shot?
Right. You know, my guess is that it was something like wanting to be supportive of a black business historically black business. Because, legally hotels couldn't be segregated in Memphis, but.
Oh, okay. By then. Sure.
But
that makes sense.
It really, I think she would have wanted to support a black business.
Yeah. I'm sorry. So you were telling me the story about the.
She was in danger. Yeah. She was in danger. George Wallace got shot. She did get Secret Service coverage after that. But then she was in, she wanted them in her house, and she set up a little room. She and Conrad, her husband, set up a little room with a TV in it where the Secret Service agents could hang out. And she said that they liked the Chisholms for that. And so at the very end, she got this binder from the Secret Service that had all the pictures of the agents who watched her, also pictures of who was working in her office, also a complete itinerary from when the Secret Service started covering her to the very end of the campaign, which was the Democratic National Convention. And so she mentions that binder in The Good Fight, and there it was. In her office, in her house.
Just sitting there. Did you know immediately what it was when you just opened the...
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I can only imagine. Did you just sort of sit back with the chills? And
yes.
You just didn't even...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I found it.
Wow. I'm not a historian, but when I do this kind of work, I think, God, there's nothing... It's the quest for information, especially if you're immersed in something that maybe only you would care about, but you want to make others care about, right? You want to make it come to life. Who were the family members? Who was it that still owned the house? I mean, who's still alive now that you were able to speak with?
Yeah, they're fairly private people. I don't want to.
Oh, you might not be able to say.
Yeah, I don't want to say, but I will say Chisholm had, there were four sisters. She was one of four. And so she did not have children herself, but her sisters did. And so those are family members who are still around.
Since you said cradle to grave, I thought it was interesting that she was born in the U.S., but then because her parents are Bayesian, she went back to Barbados and spent the formative years of her youth there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she spent...
And that seems to...
It really made a difference to her. She said it did. And I think, given what we know about experiences of transnational families, I can see how that would have really been a big influence on her. So she was there from age 4 to age 10. And that's where, first of all, she met her Barbadian or Bajan grandmother. And she said that that grandmother was really taught her how to stand up for herself, how not to be afraid, how to have dignity. She really made a big impression on the little girl, Shirley. Also, she was in a majority Black country, mm-hmm. and seeing the range of Black people in that country, it gave her a sense of shock when she got back to Jim Crow America, because she'd been in a place that, yes, had a colonial, is living through a colonial legacy, and certainly had some systematic poverty, especially for Black people there, but still not the Jim Crow system of segregation, violence, disenfranchisement that existed in the United States at that time. And so coming back to the United States was a real jolt for her, and always, I think that just always gave her the sense of having a broader view of what was going on in the U.S. And finally, she says the education there in Barbados really made a difference for her. It was sort of old-fashioned colonial education, spare the rod, spoil the child kind of stuff. But
and she kind of, as you know, it smooths over the mm-hmm. the violence of that corporal punishment aspect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She does. She says, but we learned. And she really found, I think she found a lot of academic confidence, mm-hmm. Having been a student who at least survived that, if not did well. I don't have her grades from that.
Right. No, it's interesting to me, though, too, that given her personality, she was lucky to have so much time with her grandmother, because it seems like she and her mother would have clashed. Her mother seemed much more reserved and more of a sort of conformist in terms of gender roles and all of that. I didn't think, it sounds to me from your research, that both her grandmother and her father not treating her any different than he would have a son. I think that must have made a big difference in talking to her about politics. That was pretty impressive. So here's what I think I want to turn to is, with the subtitle of your book, you call Chisholm a champion of Black feminist power politics. And of course, this is a phrase that you use throughout the book. And I'm like, is the professor playing hide the ball with us? Because there's not a place where you're actually defining what you mean by that. But you're mm-hmm. showing, not telling, I think. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I'm reading mm-hmm. along and I'm thinking, I think, at the outset, I just assumed, hey, this is just sort of a precursor to Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality. But I thought, let me sort of seep this up and see if I can figure out from the context. And I remember getting to this part of the book, I think it's like page 116. And I think it's the campaign for Congress. And this is when she's now already won the primary, and you would think it would be a slam dunk because she's on the Democratic ticket. And this is an area that's probably going to vote mostly Democratic, but she's up against a Black man on the Republican ticket. And this is 1968. So this is before Nixon's Southern strategy. And it's not really clear it's not really clear how people will necessarily vote. And the race is pretty intense between mm-hmm. the two of them. Lot of pro-masculinist messages.
It's not just any Black man. It is James Farmer, who had until recently right. been the director of one of the big four civil rights organizations. So she derisively called him the national candidate because he was a big deal.
And this is a serious campaign, and I also was struck that at that time, like right before the Democratic convention, she suddenly is diagnosed with a tumor, has to have major surgery. I mean, I'm watching, you're looking at, you know, all the things that are happening here in this run up to this campaign that she just wins like 3-1, right? The votes, but the way the New York Times described it, just kind of how I just did this. They said farmer and the black woman. Like they didn't even say who she was in the Times. So kind of what I just did to him. I wasn't deliberately doing that. I was kind of being descriptive of the situation. But just the way that she faced so much sexism, mm-hmm. but there's also, I mean, I would say misogynoir, you know, but back then people were pushing her into sort of choosing between sexism and racism.
Yeah.
I think I'm seeing here, that black feminist power politics. Oh, sorry. One last thing. And then I'm thinking about the black power movement that was happening at the same time. I know I'm talking a little bit, but all the thoughts are coming together, which is we're in the middle of second wave feminism, which was largely still a white woman's movement, and sort of centered around, this sort of breadwinner liberalism, you know, centered around the white woman, you know, Betty Friedan saying, you know, the feminine mystique, we want to work, not paying attention to working class women, including black women who are saying we want to not have to work. So there's this sort of, there's sort of white feminism kind of through second wave. Then you have the black power movement that you're describing, where there was a sense that, in, you know, sort of pushing against the Moynihan Report, feeling like in black male identity, this idea not wanting to be put down or overshadowed by the black matriarch, which was condemned in the Moynihan Report, like all these things, mm-hmm. and there she is, just mm-hmm. trying to get some power so she can affect the kind of change that she thinks would help the community, and there she is, right in the center of it. So maybe that's where I got to, but can you define black feminist power politics? Because I don't know where to go from there.
Yes. I'm happy to. I do have whether adequate or not, I do have a little spot on page 3 where I try. To explain.
I read too fast. I probably underlined that and didn't.
Well,
okay. I'm on page 3. Okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe I can explain it a little bit better. So what I call it there is black feminist power is a vantage point across categories of identity that locate points of intersection. So there's the intersectionality.
Oh, I see. Where the italics is. Yeah.
With common interests. So points of intersection with common interests. So these are people who might have different categories of identity. That is, they might be black, brown, woman, LGBT, but they're not identical. Well, so what she sees is across these categories, and she sees these points of intersection mm-hmm. with the common interests, and then use the points to bring pressure on the present configuration of power. So it's a coalition. It's an idea about coalition.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah. And
I think, you know, so this is my fault because it literally, if you look at my book, it's marked up right above with a star. And then I see what I call black feminist power. And then, of course, I don't see the word politics. So, like, as if that makes a difference. No, this is the perfect definition.
I should have put that in italics.
Maybe
for the
paper edition. I'm a terrible reader.
Are you kidding me? You're reading. You're asking me these questions that like go deep into the heart of the book and the process that like most people would never notice. So
I was a nightmare as a student. I can't even imagine what my classmates thought of me. You know what I mean? Like I probably had to just shut up a little bit.
Well, you're putting it to use now. but you know what? I really
unpack that. Then tell me how that plays out though in her policy and in her life.
Yeah. Well, so here's the thing is she's seeing, so let's take that 1968, congressional campaign. So it's the first time it's been redistricted. So, her future congressional district in Brooklyn has been redistricted. So now it's going to be a black person is going to get elected. Right.
Right.
So
Wait. You can't just say it like that because I am a lawyer. It wasn't done. Okay. Explain how it was done and how it didn't just like pass a voice get redistricted.
Well, the state legislature redistricted it on a court order. And the court order was from, ironically, from someone in the Liberal Party who had sued to make a contiguous, now I'm forgetting the term, but a continuous, contiguous, uniformly sized district that not only was the existing 12th district this really, it looked like a salamander or something.
I'm looking at your picture in the book. Yes, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. But it also, the districts in Brooklyn didn't have the same amount of people in them. And the result of that was that the large, very large Black population in Bed-Stuy was cut up into all these different districts. And so Black people did not have the weight for voting in a congressperson. So that lawsuit was successful, and the court order was that the state redistrict. Now, as you picked up, I know you know this, that somebody else took credit for the lawsuit. Someone who was one of Chisholm's nemesis.
It's like syllabi. It's syllabuses or nemesis. Nemesis.
Nemesis.
It's a Greek term, so maybe it'd be nemesises. I don't know.
Okay. Well, anyway.
I don't know. Don't ask me. Someone else will. If you know, you can write in and correct me. That would be nice. Okay.
Yes. Thank you. we'll say nemesises as
a placeholder.
As we did in English. So, so he said, he made a kind of a career on, well, I'm the one who got this district redrawn, and Shirley Chisholm just, you know, she wouldn't help me when I was doing the lawsuit, and then she just took advantage of it and got into Congress.
That's Andrew Cooper.
Andy Cooper. And he knew her from way back. They didn't get along. They were in the Unity Democratic Club together, which was the insurgent organization that eventually pushed out the, you know, white-led Democratic boss club. Mm-hmm. But his lawsuit was eventually, when it came up, I forget the correct term, but maybe you know this. It was the court said, well, this has already been decided. The district is going to be redrawn on the basis of this other decision.
It was moot at that time.
It was moot.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. So it wasn't Andy Cooper who got that done. And
but then it made him feel entitled to the spot or in some way.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And it's kind of incredible, though, that case, I mean, there are so many points like that, where if there hadn't been the redistricting, that seat would not have been open at that right time. Mm-hmm. I mean, she did build the groundwork. And you talk a bit about she was part of this UDC, and that's the... If for people who live in New York, you can often see this. I'm forgetting, what is the name of the progressive/left party in New York that endorses candidates? It's like the Working Families Party. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the Working Families. So there are all these little parties, and then they say, okay, well, we endorse a candidate, but at the top of the ticket, vote Democrat, or what they'll say, right? And I think it must have been similar to that. Like, they would endorse candidates at you know, the state assembly level or state Senate, is that what they call it?
It was like that. It's actually a step further than that, in that it was rivaling the Democratic Party organization in Kings County in Brooklyn. So it really sought to unseat that particular organization. And the district leader could sometimes be the assembly person. Chisholm was elected the assembly person, but actually the district leader was another guy, Tom Fortune. So Chisholm was represented that district in the assembly, but he was the district leader for the Democratic Party in that particular organization. So but it was, you know, it started more in the way that you said, but then it wound up being the Democratic organization for that particular assembly district. Well, so back to Black feminist power and this race. So anyway, she's in the general election. I think what she realized was the demographics of the district. That, mm-hmm. yeah, she did have being, she won the Democratic nomination and being a member of that party was very, very helpful. But she also knew that women across the color line might see that, might be turned off by the masculinist language. And then she had enough Black people who knew her from politics, and she represented the district because also Farmer was a carpetbagger from Manhattan.
Because people don't realize this about even today with congressional districts, you just have to live in the state. You don't have to live in the district to run.
Yeah.
I can't believe he really ran from Manhattan for Bed-Stuy and thought that was going to work out.
Yeah. I don't know. But so she puts that together, that coalition together. She's got women, she's got Bed-Stuy residents. She's got people who've been working on civic projects in the organization. So she puts together a coalition and then they put pressure on. But her coalition, what's different about what she's going for, people can put together a coalition for any purpose, whether nefarious or not, right? But she sees that she wants to disrupt the existing power that has been oppressing Black people, brown people, women, young people, mm-hmm. poor people. So those folks were her coalition, and which is a Black feminist coalition.
Mm-hmm. She, and so when I think about what the things that her policy issues, right? Before we talk, before we get to the policy issues, the thing, because this isn't going to be so surprising to talk about, I think. What surprised me that I didn't know, I think of her as such a towering figure. And then I come to find out that she weighed under 100 pounds. And how tall was she? Was she like petite, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg? I mean, what is kind of sort of...
Yeah, barely 5 feet.
So powerful.
Yeah.
So there is this incredibly powerful person that I think of in terms of what she accomplished, even her, on her campaigns with the bullhorn, saying... What was the thing she'd say?
Here comes fighting Shirley Chisholm.
And she's tiny. And yet she was an imposing figure. I think it takes a lot to work against people's perception of your physicality. And I think she just didn't mm-hmm. care what that was and moved forward.
Yeah. The surgery she had in 68 in that campaign, that was frustrating to her because she lost a lot of weight. What she said to her husband, Conrad, the stitches are not in my mouth. I'm going to go out there. And I have a picture of her in the sound car because she rode around in a sound car announcing, and she didn't have to get out of the car. She said she wrapped a towel around her waist so that her skirt wouldn't fall down because she'd lost all that weight. And she just got back out there. And so she was larger than life
mm-hmm.
in that sense.
She also handled, you begin the book with this and then you circle back to it. And I have to tell you, I am learning from her, the way she managed people who were, being overtly racist or rude. But when you can't, most people would just try to ignore it. Do you want to talk about a few of those stories? Because I just, I'm thinking about the paycheck guy and the handkerchief guy.
Yeah. I opened the book with the paycheck guy. It's a white Southern congressman who cannot believe that she's making the same salary as he is in Congress. Here she is, a Black woman. And, I'm a historian of Black women, and the attempts to devalue the lives of Black women have been constant and relentless. And so this is a guy who constructed his worldview that Black women were simply worth less than he was. And to have this colleague making the same salary, which was $42,500 at the time,
1973.
This was actually 1969.
Sorry, 69. I'm always getting the dates wrong. Yeah.
This is even earlier. So it's worth a good bit of money. Yeah. I forget what that's worth in today's dollars, but you know, it's a nice salary. And they just voted this salary increase. And, you know, he implies that he wouldn't have voted for that if he'd known that she was going to get it. But anyway, so he can't get over this. And he keeps telling her that every time she sees him. And he says things like, you ought to get down and kiss the floor and kiss the chairs and be so grateful that you're making 42.5 just like me.
And whenever he saw her, he'd say 42.5, right?
Yeah, yep. Yep, 42.5. So anyway, so she does her research. She finds out he's got a bad heart. And so she basically goes and counsels him. Look, you know, I know this is eating you up inside and, you know, you got to take care of yourself. So I think when you see me come in here, you should just vanish. Just go away. I'm not doing it the way she.
So good.
I'm not doing it the way she did it either, because she tells the story on film in a really cool way.
But that's so incredible because, you know, we're taught again, you know, as women, we're taught don't be confrontational, you know, just keep it moving, you know. But she didn't, and she found a way. Just, you know, if he was going to be passive aggressive, she could just give it right back.
Exactly, and then she did it one better. So then she just adds this little thing. By the way, I'm paving the way for a lot of people looking like me to come in here and make 42.5 too.
It's true. It's true. There should be more.
Yeah. So if his heart didn't go out, you know, go have a problem with her making that money, then it might have had skipped a couple beats because he realized that there were more of her coming.
How about the guy that was always coughing whenever she walked by, and then she finds out what's really going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she thinks that he's sick. And, this poor man, he's really sick. And then someone's like, no, he's just getting ready. He's like implying that he's going to spit on you. And she's like, oh, well, what do I do? And she just said she got a handkerchief herself. And then she walks up to him and she spits daintily into her handkerchief. And then he looks up at her like, hey. And she said, I beat you to it, didn't I? there are other moments like that. Her humor was, she had a sharp, sharp humor. There's another moment, even when she had more, you know, it was not an overtly racist person, but someone who, she gets on the Rules Committee. She's the first woman on the Rules Committee in the House of Representatives.
That's incredible. Such a powerful committee, too. Yeah, really important.
Yeah. But everybody else is Mr. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so. The chair's calling her Shirley.
Ooh.
And she finally says, look, you know, please call me Mrs. Chisholm. Like, you're calling everybody else Mr. whatever. And he says, oh, well, now, Shirley, we're old friends, aren't we? And she says to him, well, yes, but we don't have to let everybody know, do we?
That's so good. Oh, my goodness.
It's so good.
It's so good. I mean, it could go, you know, of course, she's famous for the line, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring your own chair. Wow. And she actually had real experiences. The delegation from Georgia, she sat at the table reading a paper. A guy comes over, says, well, this is my table. And she said, well, find another one, thinking maybe he would sit down, but they didn't. They all wouldn't sit with her. Mm-hmm. This is with his middle school lunch room.
And she says, okay, fine. You go sit over there and you tell them why you can't sit here. And she thought he might be ashamed to say it, but no, he's like, no, I can't sit over there because that woman's sitting there. Well, the folding chair might be apocryphal. I have to ask Donna Brazile about this. So if anyone knows Donna Brazile, I would really like to know the story behind this. So she's in the 2000s, she was giving interviews that say, well, my mentor, Shirley Chisholm, told me that if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. I can't find it anywhere in any of Chisholm's writings. So is it something that now it sounds like her? Right. It might be something she said. So, you know, I'd really love to know the story.
I think my friends who helped produce the podcast probably know her. So we'll check it out. We'll find out.
Yeah.
I'll put you in touch. I'll have my people talk with your people.
Cool.
Talk with her. Cool. Yeah. No, I mean, it's so funny.
There's so many
things like that. I love apocryphal stories, especially when they get memed, because then, you know, it doesn't matter if you said it anymore.
So there's another famous example, and I would tell you about the images and the substance, behind the symbol. Right. So Sojourner Truth is famous for saying, "And aren't I a woman?" Or "Ain't I a woman?"
Ain't I a woman? Yeah.
Yeah, right. So that's apocryphal.
Really?
She didn't say that. Yeah. Yeah. So my mentor, Nell Painter, is Sojourner Truth's biographer. And she reconstructed the speech at which supposedly Sojourner Truth said that. And she comes to the conclusion that no, she did not. She did not say that. But so the interesting thing, though, the substance, the reason that the symbol and the substance phrase is what I use is because Sojourner Truth, whose biography is called Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, by Nell Urban Painter, she sold images of herself. She sold postcards and carte de visite. And they said on the bottom, some of them said on the bottom.
What's a carte de visite?
It's a little collectible card. It's a visiting card.
I see.
And it's collectible and mm-hmm. People would put their photographs were novel in the late 19th century, mid late 19th century. Mm-hmm. And so, and she sold them for a quarter each, cards with her on them, like a baseball card. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sojourner Truth baseball card. And so they said on the bottom, "I sell the shadow to support the substance." And the shadow is her image. And the substance, of course, is her as a speaker, activist, mm-hmm. thinker. Mm-hmm. The substance is her life, right? But the shadow is the symbol. And the life and the symbol both exist simultaneously. The same mm-hmm. is true for Shirley Chisholm. Mm-hmm. That she is this larger than life symbol and this larger than life person, frankly. But she, the substance of who she was is at least as interesting as her as a symbol.
And let's talk, I mean, some of the substance stuff, and we still have some time. You know, she, because she'd been a former school teacher, I think she knew how to hire a good staff, and she also herself would actually, you know, she avoided going to the fundraisers and cocktail parties, and she would actually work and read through the materials, do a good night's work before a full day's work, you know, during the Monday through Thursday when she was in Washington. And I was pleased to see that, you know, people would turn to her for her judgment. This is still the case. I mean, there are people, you know, they begin to trust them. But what I was also struck by is how lonely she seemed to be in Washington and still stayed all those years. It must have been hard if she wasn't, you know, kind of into the social circuit. Did you get that sense too? It comes across.
Yeah. One of her staffers told me that she did seem a little bit lonely at times. And especially after she lived with a woman who took care of her in her house. She was a nurse at Freedman's Hospital and cooked her meals and just made sure that she was taken care of so she could concentrate on her work and reading all the bills and all that. But she did move out of that house and she had her own apartment. And so this particular staffer said to me, "Yeah, we went over because she was freaking out. She had spilled some bleach and something else. And she was worried bleach and ammonia or something. And she was, you know, you're not supposed to combine those. And she was really worried about it and didn't know what to do. And so, you know, my girlfriend, I don't know, remember if they were married at the time, they went over there to help her out and clean up the mess. And that she just sort of seemed a little bit lonely. And I think, and at that point she was married to her second husband, but he was in back at home in Buffalo, New York. And so there's a little bit of that. She was estranged from her family of origin.
Do you think it was all about the inheritance?
As far as I know, yes. The family members remember it, that it was, all of them had worked so hard to build up a nest egg. They bought the house, and they went to work, and, you know, she was part of a collective, and she got this extra inheritance from her father, and they thought that she should share it with everybody. And she didn't. She invested it in her political career.
That takes a lot of courage. I don't know that I could do that. I'm not judging her. I'm just saying like she had a vision, and I think it was probably in retrospect for the best, but that's the kind of sacrifices that she made. I'm sure she seemed like a compassionate person. I'm sure it wasn't a great feeling to be estranged in that way. Let's talk about her, what her issues were and what she got done, what kind of just slipped away. Like you mentioned, the universal child care. So, the list you had, I think it's on page 105.
Oh, decent, you found it. Okay.
Decent low cost housing. We still need that. Equality of education for our children. We still need that. Extension of daycare facilities and federal support for these centers. We need more of that. We have a bit of it. Adequate hospital and nursing home facilities. We could use those. Enforcement of anti-discrimination laws. That could be stepped up. I think it's maybe better than things were in 68, but still. And then the only thing on here that seems like was done already and more so, increase of tax exemption from $600 to $1,000 per person. It's like, of course, the only thing done is like a tax cut.
Yeah, for middle class folks, yeah.
And she also, which is not listed here, as you note, she was against the Vietnam War, but more out of concern for diverting domestic spending. So this is what she wanted. This would be a pretty good platform for anybody today. What do we do? What did on her agenda? What did she get done? And how do we take her legacy forward?
Yeah, yeah. That was her 1968 campaign, her platform, and so. Yeah, so all of those things, as you correctly point out, are still works in progress. What she got done was, in some cases, behind the scenes. So, and in some cases, were small wins. So, for example, both in the State House and in the U.S. House, she got minimum wage protections through for domestic workers.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So that was, and she really saw that as far as a legislative success, she really saw that.
That's huge.
As being important and one of the big things that she did. Obviously, the child care would have been as well. She protected a lot of schools, Title I funding, tried to keep Title I this is funding designated for poorer school districts. So really it's redistribution of wealth. It's trying to use taxpayer revenue to support the districts that needed it the most. And she worked really hard to keep those monies going to those districts, because there were some loopholes where wealthier districts were getting the funds. She tried to protect the Great Society. So here's the thing.
The Lyndon Johnson programs.
So she came into office. Johnson, of course, famously did not run in 1968.
Right.
He had Vietnam and the guns and butter issue that she was on the side of the butter. But still, she had this faith in this sort of Great Society thinking, like, we can use the resources of the country as a collective to support the least of us. Her congressional office, the people who worked there called it the true, the right, and the beautiful. The people who haven't had power in the past should have a share in the power in the economic wealth of the nation. Mm-hmm. And so she really thought, and the Child Comprehensive Child Development Act was sort of emblematic. She really thought that, okay, let's bring this breadwinner liberal state where the idea is, okay, we'll do all the good things, but it'll be for the head of the household, which will be a man, mm-hmm. and spread it to economic citizenship for everybody. Let's expand this great society to include everybody. So it's not mm-hmm. just, you know, ending segregation. It's the whole package of dismantling the economic and political obstacles for Black people, women of color, brown people, poor people, young people, etc. Mm-hmm. What she found when she got to Congress was that really she could only make sort of this incremental progress forward. So she got the minimum wage protections passed. She got some anti-discrimination in vocational education passed. Mm-hmm. She was introduced the ERA, which eventually was passed, although, you know.
Right. Yes. And I could say don't get me started.
Right,
but,
right. She was behind the scenes. Her name is not on the legislation, but behind the scenes, she was advocating for Title IX, which we now think of as two things, sexual harassment policy and athletics in colleges, but is actually a comprehensive anti-discrimination a piece of legislation. But the problem
was,
which is huge.
Yes.
And she's in that coalition of feminists who are trying to pull that together, even though all those feminists don't have exactly the same interests. But here's the thing is
she also formed the Congressional Black Caucus or the precursor, right?
Both.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So she co-founded the Democratic Select Committee, which was 2 years before the Congressional Black Caucus, and she co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus. But all of this is to say that she after that point, and especially after Gerald Ford starts to veto a bunch of things that add to the national deficit or increase inflation. Jimmy Carter gets in office. Finally, this is the first time she's serving under a Democratic president. Jimmy Carter saw the writing on the wall that there's a right turn coming in national politics, and mm-hmm. was very loath to come down on the side of these sort of great society type policies. Mm. And then at the end of her congressional career, Ronald Reagan became president and sought to dismantle. So not even not protect, but dismantle some of mm-hmm. these programs. So really that moment in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s is a high point.
Right.
And so after that, like on rules, she's trying to make sure that legislation comes to the floor, but there are no more big pieces of ambitious legislation. That was it.
Mm-hmm. And this is is 82 when she decided not to run again? I'm trying to remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she didn't run again in 82, and in 83, you know, she ceremoniously travels to the Capitol in 83 to, you know, see her replacement sworn in.
Mm. I think about, when I think about 72, when she was running for president, you know, the first woman to run on first woman to run on a major party ticket, right? I think about who ended up getting the nomination, right? George McGovern. He won. You're laughing. I was like, in my notes at the beginning of the book, I'm like, okay, so what if she had been the candidate? How could she have done worse than George McGovern? I mean, I'm just...
Right?
I don't know if anyone's ever asked that question.
No.
I mean, he won only Massachusetts and D.C. He didn't even win his home state. How could she have done worse? I mean, you're laughing, but I just think about, and I also think about his campaign, which you do write about, how they completely ignored her in the Black community. And I think about Anyway, I think a lot about you know, capital D Democratic politics and the mistake the party seems to make again and again. But have you ever thought about what would have happened? Do you think she could have done worse, honestly, than him?
Maybe.
Don't you think she would have won New York, at least? I mean.
Well, she might have.
Oh, you're thinking.
She had, there were a lot of people with their knives out for her in New York.
The old history.
Yeah, but she might have. She probably could have won Massachusetts. She did.
Right.
She came in.
And D.C.?
Yeah, she came in second in Massachusetts in the little caucus that they had at the beginning of 1972. So, and D.C., So, yeah, she might have. That's a really good point. I've never thought of it that way.
I don't know. I know. It's like real. And then she would have been blamed for only getting, Massachusetts. Yeah, we sort of forget how things work out.
The blame would have been because of, well, how could we have let this black woman run, right? How could we have let her run? The blame now is that the black people and the women sidetracked George McGovern so that he was not electable. That's
okay. Well, I mean, we know to look, it's like a template. We know who to blame, right? It's just like pick the event. We'll just blame black women.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so much that obviously we left out. Are there things that you discovered or that you want to talk about that I forgot to ask you about or didn't know to ask you about?
Well, you know, I remembered that we actually didn't come back to what my parents are doing in that picture with her.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. What are your parents doing in that picture?
So my mother was the treasurer for Chisholm for President Massachusetts. And they didn't have much money, so my mom has told me the story of she had to sit on the floor to count the money, the donations that came in, and to endorse the checks and prepare the deposits to put them into the account for Chisholm for President. But so she was the treasurer, and my father is a journalist. Who was, he covered the campaign for the Boston Globe and the Boston Phoenix. Mm. And they had, they were in a group, again, a coalition. They're an interracial couple. And they kind of found their people with Sondra Graham and some other neighborhood activists in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who were trying to draft Chisholm and successfully drafted Chisholm to run in Massachusetts. And so they were in from the beginning. And they were around the campaign and they went to Miami. So I'm sitting in the archives in Brooklyn at Brooklyn College. There are some photographs that were donated to that collection. And I see Chisholm and there's a woman up telling her something in her ear. I don't think she's giving her a kiss. I think she's telling her something in her ear. And I look and I see the woman looks a little like my mom. And I looked down and her feet looked just like my mom's feet. So I send the picture to my mom. I'm like, Mom, is this you in Miami? And she said, oh, yes, that was my favorite dress in 1972. It's so fun going in the archives and seeing her. So anyway, that's what they were doing with her.
So even though you didn't dedicate this book to them, what have they said about it since they were so close to her?
Well, they're really excited about it. And they say like, we have never felt excited like we felt when we were working on that campaign a little bit with Obama. They kind of got some of that back, that excitement for politics, but they were drawn into politics by her.
And how do we all together, and you're making your contribution by doing a cradle to grave, honest, biography, with details that she might have argued with you about, but are supported by the evidence that, and I think it's great. But what else can the rest of us do when it's so easy in our society today to erase people? How do we maintain her legacy? I know you mentioned, I guess, BC and other places that are doing that work, but what can the rest of us do who admire both the shadow and the substance of Shirley Chisholm?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, first of all, learn what you can about her. Learn the story. But ask yourself, too, how exceptional was she? You know, that yes, she's an exceptional person because she's the first to do this, but she's mm-hmm. also a human being. And human beings can do amazing things without being completely perfect. Mm-hmm. So if you are not perfect, if the person you want to be in a coalition with is not perfect, still try to be in a coalition with them so that you can move something forward, or at least protect the people who need protecting the most. You don't have to be perfect.
I love that message. That's absolutely true. And I think that's why it's great that you show the human side of her, flaws included. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Well, how do people find the book and find you, Professor Curwood?
Well, the best way to find the book is you can order directly from UNC Press, uncpress.org. You can also find it wherever books are sold. Please, I encourage you to, I'm sure all your guests say this, but go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it for you.
Order it.
If it's not on the shelf, it's distributed through all the regular channels. And if you're looking for me, you can go to my Commonwealth Institute for Black Studies page or the Department of History page at the University of Kentucky. It's in the College of Arts and Sciences, uky.edu. And you can read my bio as well, which is much shorter than Shirley Chisholm's. This one is a bit of a doorstop. And my mother did actually fall asleep reading this book, by the way.
And she told you.
Well, I was there.
Oh, man.
I was visiting. And I was there for an event at the Harvard bookstore. And she was.
Oh, because she's still in Cambridge.
Still in Cambridge. And she'll never live this down. But, you know, we're sitting there in the living room and I don't know what I was doing, answering email, and she's reading the book and I look over and there she is, fast asleep on the couch. So, but I hope other people do not fall asleep reading the book. I'm sorry, Mom. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just to make you feel better, whenever I do a television appearance, my mother always has a comment to make about my hair or my makeup, and it's never right, Anastasia. It's never right.
Oh gosh. I'm sorry. Well,
Mom. And I'm not sure that she's read my books either, but I think she's read some of them. She's proud. Our moms are proud of
us. She's very proud. Mom is very proud. It's just that it was nice and quiet, and she just, you know, drifted off. It happens to anyone.
Yeah, but it won't happen to any, didn't happen to me, and it won't happen to future readers.
No, I hope not. I hope it's a page turner. So anyway, please. And you can find me on Twitter at Curwood A is my Twitter handle. So
lovely.
Yeah.
That was an incredible conversation. I have the feeling that we are going to hear much more, not just about Professor Curwood, but also about this really important biography. I really hope you get the chance to learn more about Shirley Chisholm. There's quite a lot here that I didn't actually get a chance to talk about. I mean, some of my favorite parts of this book are the discussions of what a clothes horse Chisholm was, how she liked to dress, how her staff helped her streamline that whole aesthetic process so she could focus on doing the work she needed to do for Congress without worrying about, you know, her hair, her nails, and her suit. I found, in addition, so much that was of interest in her relationship with her first husband, who was incredibly supportive of her in her early career and ongoing. One thing Anastasia Curwood and I did talk a bit about is how she had major surgery, how Chisholm had major surgery during her first run for Congress. And you heard us talking about how, even against doctor's orders, she wanted to campaign. She said, you know, my mouth is fine, even though I've had surgery, and that's all I'm using to campaign. And what her husband did is he literally carried her down the stairs to bring her into what they would call a sound car, a car that had kind of a megaphone or speaker on top so that she could go around the neighborhoods and see the people who would be voting for her. Also, both her first and her second husband were behind the scenes making her life easy when she was home in the district. They did all the meal preparation. There's a lot here to learn about her. The other thing that we hinted at is that this wasn't supposed to be a hagiography. This is supposed to be a real portrait of an ordinary person who is spectacular, larger than life, but who could be any of us, who isn't perfect. And it's really great that Curwood had the courage, despite her reverence for Chisholm, to talk about some of those rough spots and rough moments. And I will let you discover those for yourself when you find this book. Thank you so very much for listening. I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think. Send me an email to bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to us at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find us.